Fan Club Wallet, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will explore the stories, traditions, and timeless melodies that have shaped our understanding of this art form. Today, we turn our attention to one of the towering figures in Western music, Ludwig van Beethoven. When we think of Beethoven, we imagine stormy symphonies, heroic piano sonatas, and a composer who seemed to battle fate itself. But behind the image of the untouchable genius was a man of contradictions, fierce, vulnerable, stubborn, tender, and deeply human. Today's episode will focus on those layers. The Beethoven of history, the Beethoven of myth, and the Beethoven whose music still speaks across centuries. Beethoven was born in Bonn in 1770, but it was in Vienna that he made his name. He arrived as a virtuoso pianist, dazzling audiences with his improvisations, and quickly became known as their heir to Mozart and Haydn. But what makes him different, what makes him endure, is not just his mastery of form. It is the way his music carries struggle. The Fifth Symphony's four notes, da-da-da-dum, have become a shorthand for destiny itself knocking at the door. His Ninth Symphony, with its ode to joy, remains an anthem of hope and humanity. In his lifetime, Beethoven's music was already treated as something larger than art. It was legend in the making. And yet, the Beethoven we so often imagine, scowling, wild-haired, pounding the piano, is the only part of the story. He was also a man plagued by illness, family conflict, and above all, the loss of hearing that began in his 20s and grew worse with each passing year. By the time he composed some of his greatest works, he was almost completely deaf. And still, he continued to write symphonies, sonatas, quartets, music he could no longer hear with his ears, but only with his mind. That tension between human limitation and artistic transcendence is part of why his story resonates. It feels mythic, a man cut off from sound, yet creating some of the greatest soundscapes in history. There is also mystery in Beethoven's private life. Though he never married, he left behind letters filled with passion. None more famous than his secret declaration to the so-called immortal beloved. We don't know for certain who she was, but her shadow lingers in his music, in the tenderness of the moonlit sonata. in the longing of his late quartets, in the soaring lyricism of the Emperor Concerto, the immortal beloved has become not just a historical riddle, but a symbol, a reminder that behind every composition lies a beating heart. So today, we will step into his world through stories, through reflection, and of course, through his music. We will now hear myth and memory, how they surround his life, how his struggles shaped his sound, and how his stories continue to echo across time. Stay with me for the next half hour as we explore Beethoven, not only his genius, but the human being, the myth, the voice that still speaks to us all. This is Melodies on Myth, every Friday at 3 p.m. only on CFRC.ca.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIS.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
Thank you.
The year is 1812. Beethoven is in his early 40s, already a giant in music, but also a man in turmoil. His hearing is slipping away. He's restless, lonely, and yet he's in love. From a small inn in the spa town of Teplitz, he writes a letter. The words are fevered, aching, and desperate. But the name of the woman he writes to, it's never revealed. The letter begins with a phrase that has haunted musicians and historians for two centuries. It reads, "To my immortal beloved." Beethoven's letter was never delivered. It was discovered after his death in 1827, tucked away among his belongings. 3 long pages of handwriting, full of contradictions, moments of soaring devotion followed by despair, then resolve. Even in bed, he writes, my thoughts go out to you, my immortal beloved, my life, my all, farewell. But who was she? That's the mystery. Was it Antoine Brunato, a married aristocrat he adored? Was it Josephine Brunswick, his piano student and possible secret love, or someone else entirely? Theories abound, but no one knows for certain. But the letter itself has become a myth. You see, the idea that behind all of Beethoven's genius, all of his music, was an unfulfilled love that burned in silence. He never married, but he poured everything he could not say into his music. The aching second movement of the sonata, the tenderness of the fourth piano concerto, the storm and the triumph of the fifth symphony, all of them can be read as letters to another kind, written not on paper, but in sound. When he could no longer hear, Beethoven wrote as if composing directly into silence, music only he could imagine. Scholars often call that his late style, but in a way, it was also his most intimate diary. His only way of saying, this is what I feel, this is who I love. What makes the immortal beloved letter so powerful is that it collapses the distance between the great composer and the man himself. We usually imagine Beethoven as the scowling genius, pounding the piano, battling fate, but here, in his own words, he is vulnerable. He worries about distance, about absence, about the impossibility of their love. He writes, love demands everything, and rightly so. Thus it is with me towards you, and with you towards me. It's raw, it's human, and it reminds us that even the most legendary figures ache in the same ways that we do. The woman he wrote to may never have even read the letter. She may not even have known what she meant to him, but in a sense, she didn't need to. Because every time we hear the slow, yearning melodies of Beethoven's work, we hear her presence. Whoever she was, she lives on in his notes. The immortal beloved is not just a person. She's become a symbol of music itself, the one companion that never left him. And so, we end not with certainty, but with mystery. The immortal beloved may never be identified, and perhaps that is fitting, because Beethoven's greatest love story was not just with a woman, it was with sound. His music remains his truest confession, his eternal letter, not sealed in a drawer, but open, alive, and wanting to be heard.
Calling all women in STEM. Are you interested in joining a group that advocates for lifting up women and other underrepresented groups in STEM? Well then, WISE is the place to be. Women in Science and Engineering at Queen's University is a group of passionate women creating welcoming and inclusive spaces for future engineers, scientists, and leaders. When you join WISE, you'll have the opportunity to learn from experienced pros in the field, grow your network, and be a source of inspiration for the young women in the Kingston community. Follow our Instagram at Queen's WISE or visit our website www.queenswise.ca to learn.
And now we turn to one of Beethoven's most beloved works, the Moonlit Sonata. First movement, written in 1801, it's a piece that feels less like a sonata and more like a dream, a hushed meditation in broken chords, as though Beethoven were whispering secrets to the piano in the middle of the night. What makes this performance special is the artist behind it. Canadian pianist Marnie Laird, she's part of the Brooklyn Classical Ensemble, known for bringing a fresh yet deeply expressive voice to Canadian repertoire. Born and trained in Canada, Laird has built a career that bridges words, concert pianist, chamber musician, and even co-founder of the crossover group Brooklyn Duo, which blends classical piano with contemporary sounds. Her interpretation of Moonlit captures both the intimacy and the vastness of Beethoven's vision, at once fragile and timeless. So here is the Moonlit Sonata, first movement performed by Canadian pianist Marnie Laird with Brooklyn Classical. Listen for the way the opening chords seem to hover between shadow and light. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit squis.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Listening to a piece like that reminds me of how powerful reflection can be. Music slows us down. It creates a space where we can step outside the rush of the day and just be with our own thoughts. And then again, it's important to remember that reflection isn't always about answers. And with that, our journey together today comes to an end. You've been listening to Melodies of Myth with me, Simmer Kaur, here on CFRC 101.9 FM, Queen's Radio. Meet us back here every Friday at 3 p.m. for another journey into music and storytelling. Until then, take care, keep listening, and may you always find a little melody in your everyday life. See you next Friday at 3 p.m.
A queer history education organization, and we do that through public programs and through K through 12 programs, including curriculum development for public schools. Freedom is on our minds, and the participants at Circa in many of the programs are exploring what freedom means today in this precarious political moment. The work that ACT UP did is a model for the kind of work we need to do today.
This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. World Athletics fails sex test for women's sports. U.S. threat assessments erase T from LGBT. And One hosts History's Fest of Queer Cultural Contributions. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm Marcos Nájera.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 26, 2025. The International Track and Field Governing Body is discovering that excluding transgender women from women's sports is more complicated than its policy. World Athletics received a report from its Health and Science Department at the close of its recent championships in Tokyo. It found that during the last 25 years, up to 60 event finalists would not have passed the organization's newly instituted genetic sex test. World Athletics President Sebastian Coe contends that screening for the SRY gene is what he calls a reliable proxy for determining biological sex. However, the researcher who discovered the SRY gene says that's an oversimplification of his findings. Dr. Andrew Sinclair told the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, "Using SRY to establish biological sex is wrong, because all it tells you is whether or not the gene is present." The SRY gene can lead to a variety of differences of sex development, including those who are identified female at birth but have testosterone levels higher than World Athletics permits. The questionable sex tests give rise to harassment, questioning, and privacy violations towards all women, especially but not exclusively women who are transgender, gender nonconforming, or intersex, according to a spokesperson for Interact, an organization for the empowerment of intersex youth. In a related story, transgender runner Sadie Schreiner is taking the National Collegiate Athletic Association to court for barring her from a track and field tournament. Schreiner tried to enter the public event apart from her Rochester Institute of Technology team to avoid the NCAA's trans ban. She's suing under the New York State human rights law.
The U.S. government appears to be straddling a line between erasing its transgender citizens and labeling them dangerous terrorists. Intelligence assessments issued by the Department of Homeland Security are eliminating the letter T from LGBT. This, despite the fact that transgender people suffer the highest rate of hate crimes in the community. Threat assessment reports obtained by independent investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein mark the trend going on since early this year. The Office of Intelligence and Analysis now only refers to the LGBT+ community in the warnings it sends to state and local law enforcement agencies. However, the administration is reportedly considering allowing the use of the T word in one context. With the outrageous claim that trans people have been involved in the majority of school shootings, the Conservative Heritage Foundation is imploring the Federal Bureau of Investigation to add what it calls transgender ideology-inspired violent extremism to its list of terrorist organizations. That has LGBTQ advocates up in arms. GLAAD CEO Sarah Kate Ellis said, "The real trans terrorism is the terror experienced by trans people in this country. They are targeted with violence and threats at a 4 times higher rate than that of non-transgender people." The human rights campaign's Kelly Robinson charged conservatives with using anti-trans bias to distract from other political issues.
Nobody has mastered the art of distraction like U.S. President Donald Trump himself. He was prolific in his use of the T word in his diatribe over the current federal budget standoff. The government is set to shut down at midnight on September 30th unless the ruling Republicans and the minority Democrats can negotiate a deal to fund operations through the end of November. Republicans are guarding the upper-class tax cuts and radical spending cuts of Trump's budget plan. Democrats are holding out to restore health and other social benefits. An Oval Office meeting with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries was abruptly canceled by the president. Instead, Trump took to his Truth Social platform to excoriate his political opponents. In the list of so-called radical left policies, he blamed the Democrats for supporting gender-affirming care. It was stressed repeatedly. He cited inflated costs that exist only in his imagination for the Democrats' health care demands and linked them to immigration issues and violent crime. Above all, Trump ranted that the Democrats wanted to allow men to play in women's sports and essentially create transgender operations for everybody.
Gay men in Tasmania, who were victims of the Australian state's laws against homosexuality and cross-dressing, may soon receive reparations. The bill to offer financial redress unanimously passed the lower house on September 25th. Another measure to allow judges to hand down heavier sentences for bias-motivated crimes also got unanimous approval. To Rodney Croom of Equality Australia, financial redress will help make up for the pain and loss victims experienced and send a message that Tasmania is taking responsibility for these historic injustices. Croom won a 1994 complaint against Tasmania's sex laws at the United Nations Human Rights Council. He says that many of the men convicted lost jobs and families. Some were even driven out of the state. The upper house is expected to take the bills up in November.
In a landmark victory, the fashion design competition Project Runway has crowned its first ever transgender winner. After a competitive season, Filipina designer Vijay Floresca took home the season 21 title and the $200,000 prize. Floresca previously competed on Project Runway Philippines and moved to the U.S. in 2012, where she applied for that version of the show every year since. Floresca beat out fellow finalists Jesus Estrada and RuPaul's Drag Race alum Utica Queen for the win. Following her victory, Floresca told reporters she hopes her story inspires people who feel different and shows that it is possible to achieve your dreams. She highlighted her identity as an immigrant, a trans woman of color, stating that people need to see that we are not enemies. History is also being made in the pageant world as Vietnam has announced its first ever out transgender Miss Universe contestant. 33-year-old reality show star and singer Nguyen Hong Giang will represent her country in the international competition this November. Giang is already a household name in Vietnam, having previously won the Amazing Race Vietnam and the all-trans Miss International Queen pageant in 2018. In an Instagram post, Giang said she believes Miss Universe has opened the door to equality and hope by expanding its criteria to include transgender women, married women, and mothers. She hopes her journey shows that nothing is impossible and that your starting point does not define your limits.
The Australian horror movie Together has been pulled from Chinese cinemas following a censorship controversy. Viewers at advanced screenings discovered that a scene featuring a gay wedding had been digitally altered, using what appeared to be AI technology to replace one of the male grooms with a woman. This alteration sparked backlash online, with critics calling it a distortion and misrepresentation that disrespected the original work. Global distributor Neon condemned the unauthorized edit by Chinese counterpart Hisho and demanded it cease distribution of the altered version. This incident is the latest in a series of LGBTQ censorship in Chinese media.
Finally,
I've always wanted to interview him. He's never agreed to interview, but I'm going to ask him like some very specific questions about gay sex and see if he can even answer. I doubt he even knows.
I'm not gay, dude.
Stop.
It's not the first time conservative commentator Tucker Carlson has questioned the sexuality of former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. Carlson was speculating with his podcast guest Michael Knowles earlier this month about whether Buttigieg was feigning being gay for some kind of political advantage. Maybe not so advantageous after all, since Vice President Kamala Harris reveals in her new book that she would have chosen him as her presidential campaign running mate if she had not believed that a black woman and a gay man were too much for the electorate to handle. Buttigieg got the opportunity to respond to Carlson during an appearance on Kara Swisher's September 22nd podcast. He again declined the invitation to be interviewed by Carlson.
First of all, I do not think I want to discuss anything with Tucker Carlson.
Okay. Same, same, same.
Also, but I cannot think of a topic I would like to discuss less with Tucker Carlson than that, even though I will admit some level of morbid curiosity on what in the hell he thinks his...
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude. For the week ending September 26, 2025, follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Lucia Chappell and David Hun, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm Marcos Najera. Stay safe.
Our listeners. listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
I am sitting here wanting memories to teach me to see the beauty in the world through my own eyes.
Yes, you're right to be concerned when the government reaches out to snatch the memories that prove your existence. Fortunately, queer communities around the world have established their own independent historical preservation institutions. Even more fortunately, one of them is putting on a month-long festival where the past and the future intermingle.
They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
June gets most of the attention as the queerest month with all its pride celebrations, but October holds the distinction of being LGBTQ History Month. And since 2023, the One Institute in Los Angeles has honored the month by presenting Circa, the first and only LGBTQ histories festival of its kind in the United States. Taking place all month long across Los Angeles County and a few other places beyond, the programs feature exhibitions, performance, readings, screenings, lectures, dialogues, and parties created by artists, activists, and educators leading the movement for LGBTQ+ liberation. This year, the festival's theme is Reclaiming Freedom, confronting head-on the challenges of today while reflecting on those the community has faced throughout history, and how we can learn and rise up from those experiences. I'm Jason Jen, and for This Way Out, I recently spoke with One Institute's executive director, Tony Valenzuela, about the month-long Circa Festival and its reaction to difficulties imposed by the Trump administration and creating coalitions for strengthening community resolve at a time it's most needed. But first, we discuss the One Institute's origins back in 1952 as the country's oldest active LGBTQ organization.
It was started because some folks who used to be in, who had been in Mattachine Society wanted to start a magazine, and they did start the One magazine, which was published between 53 and 1967. And it was the first widely distributed LGBTQ publication in the country. And it's famous for many things, including its really beautiful mid-century design. But I think most importantly, because they had accepted letters to the editor, which were stories from around the country about how gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender people were living in different corners of America in the 1950s during the Lavender Scare. So it's this really amazing window into the life of folks at that time.
The One Institute is also well known for its association with creating the One Archives, the world's largest collection of LGBTQ+ materials in the world.
We at One Institute gifted that collection of over 4 million pieces to USC libraries back in 2010. So it is housed at USC, it belongs to USC, but we're still strong partners. We still act as stewards in various ways for the archive. And today we are a queer history education organization, and we do that through public programs and through K-12 programs, including curriculum development for public schools. A few years ago, we launched a new initiative here at One Institute called Circa Queer Histories Festival, which happens during October, which is LGBTQ+ History Month. One Institute felt like it wanted to make something special of the month. And so we created this LA countywide programming series, basically arts and humanities programs that deal with some you know, aspect of the diversity of our history, whether it's about an event or a notable individual in our history. And so the month is full of exhibitions, readings, screenings, lectures, workshops. This year we have roughly 45 programs. Circa has the theme Reclaiming Freedom because it's a rough year for LGBTQ people with Trump's executive orders that have targeted our communities and a couple of Supreme Court cases that went against our communities, which have hamstrung our ability to do our work, certainly our ability to get federal funding to do our work. And it's caused, you know, a lot of stress and a lot of, you know, lives turned upside down. This has obviously been felt broadly across the queer community. I mean, in some parts more than others. If you're not in a liberal state, certainly trans folks have been dealt the brunt of a lot of these executive orders and anti-LGBT rulings at the Supreme Court. So freedom is on our minds, and the participants at Circa in many of the programs are exploring what freedom means today in this precarious political moment. We are launching the month with the opening of our featured Circa exhibition, which is called The Sky is Always Falling. It's an exhibition about the history of HIV/AIDS activism in LA, in specifically about five key ACT UP LA demonstrations that occurred from the late 80s to the early 90s. Materials are sourced from the One Archives at USC Libraries. So there's, you know, photographs, timelines, posters, video, art. And the reason why we chose the subject matter is because the work that ACT UP did is a model for the kind of work we need to do today in battling what we're facing right now.
Indeed, this year's festival faced the immediate repercussions of the current Trump administration's battle against all things LGBTQ.
So last fall, before the election, we were awarded our first ever NEA grant, National Endowment of the Arts, for the Arts. This is not an easy grant to get. It's a prestigious grant. You know, you get turned down all the time. It takes work to get one. And we did. It was to support the Circa Festival. And then it was withdrawn without explanation from the Trump administration. What was more alarming was that we were also previously funded by California Humanities, which is funded by an agency called the National Endowment for the Humanities. Right at the beginning of the year, that there was a question about whether that agency would be dismantled. It ended up being dismantled by the Trump administration. I received a letter from the folks at California Humanities, I think this is like January, February, which said three things. One, that they didn't know if NEH would survive. Two, that if it survived, the grants they gave would probably be smaller than in the past. And three, that they would be abiding by Trump's executive orders. So when I heard that coming from California Humanities, an organization whose tagline is giving voice to the voiceless, I thought we were in trouble.
You're gonna need your friends. Let me tell you this again. You're gonna need your friends. Then he looks in your eyes and tells you that this is the end. Yeah.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Jason Jen. We're continuing the conversation with Tony Valenzuela, the executive director of the One Institute.
So I forwarded that letter to everyone I knew in queer arts and culture. And out of that conversation, just to see, is anyone else getting these notices? And of course, people had been getting notices about many things, including California Humanities and NEA. A bunch of people met early in the year in March and formed a coalition called the Los Angeles County LGBT Arts and Culture Coalition. And we founded that organization in order to have a community to mobilize, be able to be engaged in a conversation about what was happening to folks, track, you know, what people were losing, if they had to fire people because of loss of funding, if their organization was threatened, its existence was threatened. We just wanted to be in conversation and had decided that this effort, the coalition, would be that we wanted to keep it as a long-term regional alliance to continue to do this kind of work together, mobilization. We're also doing capacity building, professional development for the members, but we've needed something for this a long time. I've been in this space, in queer arts and culture space, for a long time. Previously, at Lambda Literary and Foundation for the AIDS Monument, and I have known how much our organizations and our individual artists need this kind of support, especially professional development support. And so we have been, this coalition has been meeting regularly every other week the entire year. We've had a public convening in July, which was all about recording data from the members about the, you know, issues that they've experienced, not just bad, but also folks were able to discuss the resources they had and that the resources they could share with other members. And then in October, we're going to do another public convening, this one with funders, to teach the members how to cultivate relationships in philanthropy. So while we're battling these, the outside, we're also wanting to strengthen the sector. And there was some good news, actually, the other day, the NEA, their requirement for, you know, signing on to gender ideology, like if an organization was going to get funding, organizations were going to be required to sign on to say that they would abide by, you know, these rulings around not doing programs around gender ideology, quote unquote. And that court case was just, they just lost that court case, which is a win for us. It wasn't at the Supreme Court, it was one of the federal courts. And, you know, we'll see if it's appealed. But nonetheless, it takes a long time. But the courts are thankfully ruling against many of these that are sort of blatant discrimination, but not against some others. The chilling effect is going to be broader than that. So anyway, this is what we're doing in the coalition, is keeping an eye on this and just making sure that, you know, now there's a group of 100 artists and arts organizations in conversation on a regular basis. And that's really helpful to all of us. My experience this year is that a lot of organizing is happening hyper-locally. And so that is actually the strategy we're taking with the coalition in LA. You know, some conversation about branching out, making this national, but my perspective and the perspective of some others is that we really want to understand what's in our backyard. In this process, we've discovered so many other queer artists and queer arts projects that are happening in, you know, the LA metro area that I didn't know about before. And so I think that we're really concentrating locally right now to, first of all, get a clear understanding of the landscape. Who are the artists? Who are the organizations? What are they doing? Where are they doing it? Understanding what the needs and the sort of the needs and the strengths of these organizations and artists are. We want to build the infrastructure here in LA County and then think about, you know, expanding outward. But we don't want to get distracted by a national conversation when there's work to do here in LA County. And it's not like we are paying attention. I know that there are actual national coalitions right now. And I feel like at a certain point, the coalitions will join. For right now, we're working locally. So my suggestion would be, see if something exists in your region. And if not, start it. There are, wherever you are, there are queer artists and organizations, and just start an informal group going in conversation, and just see what you can do locally. Is I'm sure in some places there's very little, but that's how I would start. And if anyone wanted to know how we did it here, I'd be happy to talk to anyone if they reached out to me.
To learn more about Tony Valenzuela and the One Institute, visit oneinstitute.org. And for more information about the Circa Queer Histories Festival happening throughout the month of October, visit circafestival.org. For This Way Out, I'm Jason Jen.
I've been flipping through my timeline, trying to get my mind right. Got a new agenda with a new dream. I'm kicking out the old regime. Liberation, elevation, education. The table's about to turn.
For finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Marcos Najera and Ava Davis and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was Jason Jen. The Steve Miller Band, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Janelle Monae, The Propellerheads with Shirley Bassey, and Pansy Division performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, celebrating 50 years together, David Hunt of Raleigh, North Carolina, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 3CH Wooden Victoria, KAOS Olympia, Washington, WMUU Madison, Wisconsin, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Your Queens Gales are on the road on October 4th to take on the Guelph Griffins. A win for the Gales punches their ticket to the OUA playoffs. A loss for the Griffins could spell the end of a once-promising season. Will it be the surging Gales or the struggling Griffins? Anything can happen on game day, so you don't want to miss out. Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca at 12:45 p.m. for the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 1 o'clock kickoff.
Hey, Cher. I think you're pretty funny.
I think you're pretty funny too, Tara.
Well, that's good because, you know, 30 Years of Nonsense is a great show, and we do it every Thursday from 4 to 5.
We absolutely do, and people can listen in at CFRC 101.9 or CFRC.ca.
Yeah, and we play basically all...